And welcome to our conversation today about the future of our continuing conversation about the future of transportation in our world. We're calling this Transporting Baltimore into the 21st Century. We are here today with leaders of our transportation system. In the studio, Robert Smith, the Maryland Transit Administrator for our state, is with us. Henry M. Kay, Executive Director of Transit and Development and Delivery for the Maryland Transit Administration, is back with us. William Johnson, who is Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation, and Frank Murphy, Deputy Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation, are here with us in studio. Good to have you all with us. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And folks, join us at 410-319-8888. You've clogged these phones in our transportation conversations before. Want to have your thoughts here on the airwaves? Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, and we already have some comments there that I will read. Or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Again, 410-319-8888. We will cover everything from the buses you take to the buses that don't arrive on time to the buses that do to the Red Line and more, and the JFX and driving to work, one of the most pleasant experiences all of us have every day. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So let's start with what's been a topic of real debate on this program, which has been the Red Line. And many people are arguing that the amount of money spent on the Red Line is something that was sucks all the energy and money out of everything else in transportation. That is not the panacea for the future of the city. Some people argue, others saying it is, that this is what we need to get. This is the next leg. But people fear this is the last leg that'll ever be built. Others fear that this question is this a done deal? Are there any questions in anybody's mind at this table that the Red Line is going to be built and how it will be built? Who wants to grab that one first? Give us your overview.
Well, maybe if I could, this is Henry Kay, if I could jump in on that.
Welcome back to Baltimore.
Thank you very much. It's been nice to talk to you about the Red Line a couple times before, so I'm happy to talk about it again. Yeah, the Red Line, for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, it's almost a 14-mile east-west light rail line. It would go from Woodlawn, Baltimore County, to the Hopkins Bayview campus on the east side of Baltimore City. The idea has been around quite a long time, probably more than a decade. Came out of a regional rail plan that tried to identify what the most important new corridors were in the region. MTA has been, working diligently to kind of refine the idea and put out a specific plan. During that time, we've had a real strong partnership with Baltimore City and Baltimore County, with a number of organizations, neighborhood groups, had lots of input during that time. And so the idea is, I'd say if you from 30,000 feet, probably looks the same as it did 10 years ago. But by the time you get down to the ground, it's been refined quite a bit. So we've the alignment's been changed. We've made decisions about the rail technology, settled on light rail. We've made decisions about whether it should be above or below ground and where. And 1,000 small details that are going to help it work and serve communities as well as it can. There's certainly no doubt in my mind it's going to happen. We got an enormous opportunity last year when the General Assembly increased transportation revenues in the state. The Red Line was one of the single largest investments that the state is making with that money. It sets us up, puts us in an excellent position to compete for federal funds, which are a very important part of the funding plan. And we'll know over the next year whether we're successful competing for federal funds. And if we are, then we have everything we need to break ground in 2015 and start serving people in late 2021. It's an expensive project. There's just no getting around that. It's the current capital cost estimate is $2.6 billion. So it'd be one of the biggest infrastructure investments ever made in the region. Our belief at MTA is that in order to have, a good transit system, you need to have a series of strong trunk lines that are well connected to one another. Because all your short bus lines, the city's very successful Charm City Circulator, any of MTA's bus lines, they work because they connect, to a strong trunk, a reliable, fast, high-capacity trunk. And right now we have that in the north-south corridor with light rail, the northwest corridor with metro. We don't have anything in the east-west corridor. So the idea is the Red Line comes in, it connects to those existing lines, and then it becomes the way that, the bus services around it work well.
Go ahead.
Yes. This is William Johnson, DOT Director for City of Baltimore, and just piggybacking off what Henry has just said, multimodal is the key. And we look at the Red Line as part of that missing link, if you will, especially when you're looking at the east-west corridor in the city of Baltimore, in the Baltimore region. If you look at a map, there are light rail services that currently connect as you're running north and south. You've got the Central Light Rail Line and the Metro, but east-west is lacking, and that's despite the fact that you see all of this new development pressure coming into the southeast Baltimore corridor. So we think that the Red Line will help in terms of connecting the east-west corridor with existing north-south transportation lines. It'll provide services to neighborhoods where 30% to 45% of the working populations use transit. And we're looking at the amount of investment and commitment that's come from the state, the amount of work that's going in from the city. We think that overall this is just going to be a win-win situation for Baltimore.
Now, there have been a lot of people, some of the major leaders in parts of the city, like from District 46, who have been opposing this with some ferocity, talking about the disruption to neighborhoods, talking about the cost, which just keeps rising all the time, questions of where the cost is going to come from. And one of the big questions is, if this is built, will there be any money left for anything else in transportation? Because you might build a red line, but one of the big issues here is connectivity in this city, which I think everybody would agree, maybe you wouldn't agree, but is pretty abysmal. And kind of those kind of internal issues that are huge. But the question of is this the way to spend that kind of money?
Well, this is Robert Smith, and
good to have you in the studio.
Good morning, Robert. And I'm glad to be back at the MTA. One of the things
There's a lot of returning faces here in our transportation system. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, a couple of questions you have there. The Red Line isn't our only project that we're operating, and I think Henry did a really good job of explaining why it's important and what we need to do and giving a history of it. But the MTA is doing a variety of things. We're adding MARC weekend service within the next 30 days by the end of this year. Those are things that we're doing. We're also continuing to have capital investment, building new bus garages. There's a 1940s vintage bus garage that's being rebuilt. We're putting a new one in that's state-of-the-art, that's going to be environmentally friendly. We're doing overhauls on our Metro train cars. Our Metro system now is 30 years old, and we're celebrating those 30 years. But we're also doing a life-extending maintenance on those, doing track work, and we'll be replacing those cars as well. So there are a lot of other things that we're actually doing. We're keeping our buses up to date. But more importantly, you asked a question about connectivity and whether it works. The MTA is being a lot more strategic about this. We're modernizing our system. We have a plan called the Transit Modernization Plan, and it's an opportunity to bring technology and all of our projects and systems up to speed and actually working a lot better for us. And the first one, Mark, you may be aware of, we're pushing out now our bus network improvement project, where we're involving all of our major stakeholders, whether it's business leaders in the city, elected officials, the riding public, our employees. So it's a program going forward that it's not only short-term but long-term in terms of making the Baltimore region a much more viable area.
So the question I have, what does that mean specifically, though? I mean, because one of the things that you have you look at Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. is now in the process of laying down 19 miles of track for trolley cars. They have another 22 coming. They've been able to develop a system that Baltimore turned down 40 years ago, which was our subway system, which we could have had but don't have. So they have connectivity. You get off the train. You can catch a bus. There are bike shares. There are car shares. We don't have any of that. We have very little of it, I should say. And we do not have this kind of connectivity. You have to walk blocks to catch the next bus. They don't sync with when the trains are coming. I mean, so even though it's wonderful that we're building garages, the question is, what are we doing about changing the nature of our transportation system so that it actually is usable for most people who have to use it?
Well, William Johnson, the city of City of Baltimore DOT again. Well, in the spring of 2014, we are planning to launch a bike share program for the City of Baltimore. We're going to start that in the Central Business District and looking to expand that throughout the city. In addition, we've been working on a transportation master plan where we're looking to expand and increase our infrastructure to expand a bike mode share by to 8% by 2020. We are looking at a master plan for expansion of the Charm City Circulator, which also facilitates a number of connection points, if you will, between the different modes of transportation, and working closely with MTA as they're expanding and revitalizing, relooking at their bus network improvement program. So there are a lot of things that are ongoing to help facilitate connectivity in the interim, in addition to those investments that are going into some of the major projects in the region.
One of the things, go ahead.
I was going to say, Mark, with regard to your comparison between Baltimore and Washington, I think that's very instructive. I mean, it's helpful for all of us because we don't have to go far to be able to see an example of a region that has taken a different tack,
right.
You know, with regard
right.
to transit and how it connects to other kinds of transportation services. And I think it gets to this issue that I was talking about before, which is you need a basic framework, you know, upon which you can lay other transportation services. So Washington, the most important thing that it has is 106 miles of heavy rail. And they very aggressively pursued that. They got very favorable consideration from the federal government during the time that, you know, the bulk of that was being funded. Each of the states, including Maryland, has, you know, made very significant investments in that. But what that gives, I mean, Metro doesn't go everywhere. I mean, there are many, many parts of the region, including some very popular parts that don't have Metro stations. But what it does is that when
some
you
of those
wanna,
didn't get them because for their own racist reasons.
They made their own decisions about that.
Right.
Yeah, there's good stories there. But the reality is, you know, it's 100 miles is a lot, but it's a very big region. And so, you know, in many cases, you know, there's no metro station that's walkable. This is not the New York City subway. They weren't able to come and build that later. And Washington is not a dense city like that, so it wouldn't justify it. But the reason it works, and it works in the way that you're describing, and it works in a way that the district can justify building a bunch of miles of streetcar lines, is because they have that underlying network. So it makes sense for me as a neighborhood business person or as a resident to get on a streetcar and ride a mile or so. And then the place I'm going is a Metrorail station. If I didn't have Metrorail to go to, the slow trip on that streetcar might not be worth it to me. So, you know, in Baltimore, we have to investments in the Red Line sort of focus on creating that underlying framework. And then all of us, the city, the MTA, have to step in and provide those supplemental services. And bike share is a great example. The circulator is a great example. You know, but it also can be some simple things. It's good quality sidewalks. It's pedestrian lighting. It's safe crossings. I mean, those are... Because all transit riders are always pedestrians too, and so you know we need to invest in those parts of the network to make sure that it all works together.
So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. We clearly want to hear from you, those of you who take the bus. We've had a lot of bus riders on this program just talking about what they think this transportation system should look like. Folks who are living where the Red Line is being constructed, your ideas and all that. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page. We have a Facebook comment from Tyrone Thorpe. He said, I am not really happy about it, which I think he's talking about the Red Line. He said, since I'm bound to MTA, I possess neither car nor a license. I'm very much dependent on the MTA. The timetables and tardiness really make the MTA live up to its other meaning. Might take a while. Until we have subways, elevated commuter rail, and a loop line a la the Yamanote line in Tokyo, travel will feel slow and people won't be able to feel that they can go anywhere fast and with a measure of convenience. We also need connection between downtown and Towson, between downtown and D.C., between downtown and Columbia. Needless to say, more investment in infrastructure is called for. So let's take a bit of what he was talking about here. We know that... With all due respect, people do call the MTA sometimes. Might take a while. But let's talk about that. One of the things, let's start there with some of his questions and hear what these listeners are thinking at 410-319-8888. Some bus drivers have said to me when this rumor took place that if you're out sick, that means the line is down. But they clearly explained to me what the issue was. He said, no, it's not the case. That if someone is not in, doesn't come in, then there's a pool of people you're supposed to pull from. But if that pool doesn't show up and they're late, there's not enough people, because we don't have enough drivers, period, in our system, then that makes it late because they think I'm late, but I'm not late. I'm on time. It's just that we didn't have the other bus, so that made everything seem late, and that you have a problem. You have a personnel problem at MTA, not enough drivers, and that was problem A. But let's just stop there. So what about the question of people feeling that the MTA is ineffective, that it doesn't get there on time, that there are too few buses and routes? Your response to that?
Yes. This is Robert Smith. That is something that we're addressing. One of the things in our bus network improvement project that we acknowledge as we're talking is that our service is not what we want it to be. We clearly understand that. Our listening sessions are telling us that. We know these things. But what we're doing is we're looking at ensuring that we can speed that up. We're working with the city. We're looking at our routes. And that's what this project is all about. It's about going where people live, taking them where they want to go. But in addition to that, finding ways that we could make that a lot quicker. We need to speed that up. In terms of some of the issues at the MTA, they're well chronicled. It's things that we're aware of. And as the new management, it's something that we're doing, and we're taking short-term steps to address that right away.
So what do you all think is the bottleneck? Is the problem with resolving an issue that some people think on the outside seemingly easy to fix, which is the timing of buses, how they get there, when they get there? Is part of the problem we don't have enough drivers? Is that part of the problem? Or some people would argue.
Occasionally, transit systems, whether it's some you've enumerated, the Washington metro area here, we may have occasion that there are insufficient drivers. And there are times that, frankly, we've got to look at the routes that we have now. The way we have our routes structured, do we stop too many times along a route? We've got to find, and as we're listening to our passengers, how do we listen to them and speed the service up? Do we look at limited stop routes? Do we put in more of our quick routes that we have? Those are the types of solutions that we've got to put out there. And I think some of the best ways to do that is through our listening programs that we have. We've over the last couple of months, we've been out talking with them, and we've recognized from within our area where these issues are. And you'll see that starting this December, our recommendations will start coming in, and into next year, we intend to make changes starting in 2014.
Well, some people have written to me before the show asking about the Baltimore Network Improvement Program that people are talking about that's taking place. And the biggest question was, this, I know you have six workshops that are scheduled, right?
Yes.
But the question was, why are they being scheduled from noon to 2 on a Tuesday when most people are working and they can't get there?
That's a good point. It's not just the workshops that we're having. There will be a series of pop-ups where we actually go to transit centers and transfer points where our passengers are. We have a website that we use. We have a hotline that folks can call into, and there's a variety of ways that we're doing that. So the meetings that we're having are just one of a variety of ways folks could give input, or our passengers can.
Folks, we're going to take a brief break. Join us here at 410-319-8888. It's your chance to talk to the men who are making decisions about the future of your transportation. We'll come back to your calls and ideas. 410-319-8888. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on WEAA on The Mark Steiner Show. And support for WEAA is provided by the Walters Art Museum, presenting the exhibition Egypt's Mysterious Book of Fayum, an ancient papyrus is displayed alongside Egyptian statues, reliefs, jewelry, and ritual objects to the intriguing stories like that of Sobek, the crocodile king who makes the sun rise. We're here with four of our leading transportation officials. We want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. In the studio here to join in on this conversation. We are here with Robert L. Smith, who is the Maryland Transit Administrator, Henry M. Kay, Executive Director of Transit Development and Delivery for the Maryland Transit System, William Johnson, who is Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation, and Frank Murphy, Deputy Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation. Many new folks coming in and back to our system. 410-319-8888 is the number here. One of the things that came up in our program here was somebody suggested, it was Jimmy Rouse's idea, that when it comes to kind of change the nature of transportation in the city, that he thinks can be done by 2014, and many people call in thinking the same thing, is why you can't have, to have bike share and zip cars at every light rail and every subway stop for people to use when they come out. And I know you said we were talking about phasing it in, but the question is, maybe why do you have to phase it in? Why in a year's time it doesn't seem to me to be that difficult to put bike shares especially or to create parking spaces for zip cars and expand those programs so there's easy access as soon as you walk off of whatever subway or light rail stop you have.
Yeah, that's great. The city is moving aggressively, and we're currently scheduled to launch the Baltimore Bike Share Program in the spring of 2014. And we're going to start with about 250 bikes, primarily in the Central Business District. And that program is going to be expanded out throughout a network throughout the city. So you can't just hit the ground with every location covered with the vendors and operational issues. It's better to have a phased approach, but we don't see this being a matter of years, but a matter of months in which we're looking to expand that network throughout the city.
So, but the question again, I guess I'd push a little harder on it is, I mean, it seems whenever we create programs like this or the circulator, they are created for the benefit of a mostly white middle class population who goes downtown, and not for the people who use the system every day, which are mostly working-class people of color in the city. But it seems like we're always experimenting with programs that always start in the middle of downtown and not in the middle of where people live. In other words, somebody getting off on the subway stop at Mondawmin, getting a bike share, could pedal to his next place in Park Heights, leave the bike, someone else can pick it up. So there really is a question, but why is it always start there? Why isn't it just starting right in the middle of where people are?
Hi, this is Frank Murphy from Baltimore City DOT. Two comments on that.
Yeah,
one of them is if you go to New York, they've got a very robust bike share program, but even they don't put it at every subway stop. They've concentrated on places where more potential use. What they do is they've picked out places where the usage is more likely to occur, like Union Square, for example, has a 50-bike location. But they don't do it at all the subway stops. I think what we're looking at is where we want to start with the areas that have the most potential, like maybe a Penn Station, for example, where you have people coming from out of town that clearly don't have cars because they've come into town on Amtrak. But I don't think there's any question that, you know, assuming it's as successful as we hope it is, we'll be looking at expansion potential, and we'll be working with the vendor to pick out places where we think the use is most likely to occur. So Penn Station, for example, probably has more potential than maybe some of the lighter use light rail or metro stops. So we want to start big and use the spaces that are more likely to have use first.
So so how long will it take to implement the program fully?
Well, I guess it depends on what fully is. We're rolling out next spring, and that's going to have places where we're most likely to have use. And we hope, of course, that this builds usage to the point where we can keep growing. There is we have gotten funding in place, and that is part of the issue. It is something that does cost money to operate. So depending on how big it is, we'll have to go back to the well and make sure we have money available.
And we also – this is William Johnson again. We also look at this as part of a long-term strategy. This is not a fly-by-night program. We see this as part of the overall vision and future of transportation in the city of Baltimore, and we're committed to this as a long-term strategy. So that expansion, I look at it continuing as long as we can continue to see usage and demand for the system. We're going to be doing things to try to encourage citizens and residents to use the system as a means of as a primary means of connecting from one form of transit to the other. It's part of our overall strategy going forward.
So one of the worries about the Red Line, coming back to that, how it fits into what you all were talking about, is that we'll get to these calls coming in 2 seconds, 410-319-8888. Mary, you're the first caller up. Oh, here's another email. Let me just read this chat that just came in here. What about all the neighborhoods north of North Avenue? There's nothing besides buses up there right now, besides Hopkins' own buses and Homewood, which begs another question about whether it's an interference or a help for every college campus to have their own bus system, as opposed to relying on city buses, which gets people to actually meet each other and be on the bus, rather than having all these kind of separate private systems we're creating here in Baltimore. Well, what are your thoughts about that? First, with that question about all the neighborhoods north of North Avenue.
But I didn't quite understand it. We've got pretty ample bus service that runs north-south up through a lot of the neighborhoods. If that's
but they're saying
mean.
There's nothing there besides buses. There's no zip cars. There's no bike shares. There's no.
Well, there actually are zip cars in a couple of locations up there. And we have located some near some – I don't say we. The zip car has been located near some campuses, and that's one of the rollout strategies is places campuses for bike share options and zip car options.
And just to add on to that, I'll reiterate that we're launching the program. We're starting in the program being the bike share program and the bike share network. But our master plan would provide for expansion throughout the city.
Let's go to the phones here. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we talk to four of our leading transportation officials in the state and city. Mary in Pikesville, you're on the air.
Hi,
Mary. You're on the air. Welcome.
Okay, I didn't hear that little clicking sound. Yeah, listen, Mark, thanks for having this show. I was listening. I had to call in. I use public transit for a lot of things in my life, and I really feel very strongly that no extra resources should be put into transit in this state until we do more with the resources that we have and we run the system we currently have correctly for the people who use it day in and day out. I just want to give you a couple of examples. Okay. I was on a bus going up and down Reisterstown Road where the driver was dozing off pretty much every couple of stops. He'd wake himself up and keep driving. I was on a bus going up and down Liberty Road where I'm not making this up. The driver would stopped off at the drugstore, ran in, grabbed something, got back on the bus, started it back up again, stopped off at the dry cleaners, ran in and got something, started the bus back up again, ran into a bakery, ran in, picked up his children from daycare, got back on the bus. This went on, and I said, well, we're just along for the ride while you run your errands today, and everybody had a good
Mary, you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. Did you get me?
Yeah, that last time, Marita, because somebody must be calling you.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Well, that's my point, and the buses need to be cleaner, they need to be well-maintained, and they need to run on time. Very often, the buses are running late, and then when a bus does show up, it's not in service. I can't figure out what that's all about. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for that comment. And we're finding that when we have these, we need to know about those and these types of issues that are coming in. There's nothing more important to us and for me and the leadership of the MTA than to have a safe service. And I believe she mentioned the big ones there. And what we're looking at in terms of on-time performance and taking care of our current service, the investment in our current core service is what our bus network improvement project is about. That's why we're listening to our customers and working with our stakeholders. The specifics that she's brought up today, I'm not aware of, but those are the types of things that we've got to weed out. And Mark, you've raised a good point here, and so did the caller. Our focus now is not only just the red line. We're doing a variety of things, just as the city. We've got to fix our current service. We know that. Our core service of light rail, metro, and bus is what we're focusing on. That's the core of our business. And as we build the red line, as we look at neighborhood shuttles and zip cars and the like, it's important for those to actually work. And we seek out and want the type of feedback that the caller just gave us, and that's going to help us do better.
So that's you mentioned the red line. So there's some other things that come up here in some of the emails and things we've gotten about the red line and where and how everything fits. I mean, the question is, what amount of money is going to be spent on the red line, and what's left for other transportation projects? This people hear the red line as this great sucking sound when it comes to all the money being funneled into this. So what does that leave?
Let me respond to that. Yeah, as I mentioned before, I mean, there's no denying the fact that the Red Line is an expensive project. So if you look at it as a pattern of investments that MTA has made in the region's transportation system over the years, you know, we're sort of able to step up and do a project like the Red Line every generation or so. You know, in the 1980s, we opened Metro in phases. In the 1990s, light rail came along. So it's time for the next investment in building out that trunk rail system that allows the rest of the system to function better. You know, if we could build the Red Line for half that much, we would. And if it were much more, we probably wouldn't be doing it. I mean, we're probably reaching the point where it's at the upper end of, you know, what we can reasonably justify in the region. So, you know, there's absolutely no denying that. But I think if you were able to see a comparison of what the MTA invests in operations, in maintenance, and the expansion of services each year, and you went back a few years and you looked at the Red Line period of time, and you went forward a few years, I think what you would see is the Red Line is not coming at the expense of other investments in the system. We're making capital investments in both expansion and in system preservation. We're making investments in operations. And the Red Line will represent, you know, a blip, a jump up in investment, and including leveraging additional resources, particularly federal resources, we would not have received otherwise. Those can't be used for anything other than the Red Line. And so we'll make that investment in that period of time, just as we did during the time we built light rail, during the time we built Metro. But it won't come at the expense of all the other investments we're making at the same time.
So, but now that, all due respect, that sounds great. But the reality is, where's the money going to come from? What's the state going to put into what's really needed to kind of strengthen our transportation system? And why do we need a real metropolitan wide authority that manages, that gets the system running? I mean, because the reality is that most of the jobs that people in the city want are in the county. They're not in Baltimore City.
Well,
and buses are being built, and most of the routes now are for people from the county to come into the city with Kiss and Ride, right? They don't go the other way. So, you know, we cut out Baltimore to Annapolis. That has been truncated. So it seems like we are cutting back on the costs as opposed to really investing because, and some people argue, because it's the Red Line that's taking the lion's share of the money.
You know, the perception is that the Red Line may be taking a lot of money. I'm currently going around the state with the secretary and talking about our capital transit plan for the next 5 years. We recently spoke with officials with the city. We go to all the counties in the state. And, Mark, actually, I think our riders would be quite surprised of the things that we have programmed to do, not only from an operational standpoint, but also from a capital investment. And it's system preservation, but it's also growth. Our modernization plan, where we want to, within the next year, have next bus technology throughout our system. We want to have the ability to maintain our metro cars, our MARC train stations, and so on. So there is a lot of investment, and the state is actually, in my opinion, leading the country in terms of transit investment for our riders. The Baltimore region, one thing I'm repeating myself here a bit.
Sorry?
We know we've got a lot to do, and frankly, we have a great plan. The state legislature, the city of Baltimore, and the state are all in alignment in fixing Baltimore. And there's two things they've asked me to do. One is we need to improve our connectivity. The Red Line is a key part of that. And we need to improve the speed and efficiency of it as well.
And part of the connectivity part, though, there is the Red Line, because the issues of raising money has been truncated, right? The stops have been truncated.
Well, actually, if you look at the original rail system plan, the current Red Line plan is pretty loyal to what the priority was. It's actually even a bit longer on the east side. The idea that came out of the advisory committee, the one that gave us advice about what the priorities for the rail plan ought to be, really only had it going, I believe, to Fells Point. And then when we looked at it, and this was one of the modifications we made as we got more into the detailed planning, it really made sense to go further than that. For not very much more money, we could get all the way to Bayview Hospital, which is, you know, a really good job center, so people are going to take that train not just into downtown but east as well. And also it connects to a new MARC station out on East Lombard Street. So there's a really important intermodal opportunity that we could create there. So we've not sacrificed anything for the Red Line. If anything, it's a bit bigger. Now, the long-term plan for the Red Line is more ambitious. So it goes all the way to Dundalk. So and it's being designed to end at Bayview in a way that it can be extended later on. So the ultimate plan does have it going a bit further.
Let me open the phone so you can come back to the Red Line and your thoughts. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we have our key transportation officials joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show on our continuing look at transportation in our metro region into the 21st century, in this 21st century. 410-319-8888. Nigel, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Nigel.
I just had a suggestion to your guest. There was already a caller that was listing some what might be looked at as policy issues or behavior issues of your drivers. How about if the MTA established a Twitter account and even advertise it on their buses, as well as a text-to-number on service feedback from the public? And then you would know real-time what your bus drivers are actually doing because of the eyes of the usership. And that's all I got to say.
Excellent question. We do currently have, and I believe Henry could tell us more about it, a Twitter account. And we're more than willing to publicize that here.
But you do?
And a big, yes, we will. And a big part of what we're doing is, in order for us to improve the system, we encourage and anticipate and want to get more comments from our riding public so that we're partnering as we go forward. And Henry, I don't know.
Yeah, we have, you know, like many transit agencies, we're trying to use social media in a way to increase communication with our riders. And, I mean, as the caller pointed out, real-time feedback, you know, is very valuable in a system that's so dynamic. And a problem that's occurring at a moment, you know, by the time we really focus on it can get there, that problem may not be happening. So we have to really know about it. Yeah, we have a Twitter account. It's MTA Maryland. We put out a number of tweets every day about what's happening in our service. If people can, you know, follow our Twitter account, they can get real-time information about diversions of bus routes, about light rail service interruptions, about things that are happening on the MARC system. What also happens is that people send us tweets. So what they do is they just, you know, add our name and we search for those. And it's a way that we can have that kind of communication. So I'd say every day 5, 10, 15 tweets come in telling us about exactly the kinds of things that the callers are mentioning. And so what that does is it gives some focus to our customer service offices, our police, our supervisors, and they can go and investigate those issues and it can sort of structure the supervisory resources that we do have.
There were people here who have been critics of the Red Line system, and there's something that was written earlier. Let me read to you so we can respond to it on air here, all right? And that is that came up in the show the last time we were here. And you know this because you probably read the same things, similar things in the Daily Record and other places as critiques of the Red Line. It says that that the 14.1-mile Red Line includes a new redundant, expensive, and totally inferior 3.4-mile downtown tunnel, which accounts for close to half its cost, that's separated from the existing metro tunnel. This came up on our last program by a two-block-long underground passageway. And then this argument is that then in an attempt to save money because of the cost of building this tunnel, that now we're going to accommodate only two-car trains on the Red Line. And that kind of defeats the purpose of all of that. And so he said, further, I'm going to say that unlike the Metro, the Red Line would have no crossover tracks at all. So the question is that means the Red Line's average speed would be less than 90 miles an hour as opposed to 30 miles an hour for the Metro. So this raises a lot of issues about how this is actually going to work once it happens.
Yeah. There's a lot to that. I mean, I could spend probably several hours just talking about those particular issues. Some of those are financial, some technical, some just policy decisions. I mean, it's absolutely true that the cost of the downtown tunnel is very significant. It's really sort of driving the overall dynamics of the Red Line.
And the costs.
But I would not say there's a relationship between the decision to put the Red Line in a tunnel and the size of the stations and, you know, our decision about whether to have underground crossovers or not. I mean, those are really independent from one another. I mean, the difference between the Red Line and the subway, or really the Central Light Rail Line, is that it's being designed to fit into neighborhoods. I mean, it's going down the middle of Edmondson Avenue. It's going through the center of downtown with five new underground stations. It's going down Boston Street in Canton and through Highlandtown, Greektown. So unlike the existing lines where the stations are relatively isolated from the communities that they're in, the Red Line is very much in communities. And so everything about it has to be squeezed into those places because we have to build it in a way that is compatible and supportive of those communities, not having a negative effect on them. And so things like two-car stations as opposed to three- or four-car stations, you know, were a way that we were able to achieve that. Now, there is a substantial cost savings when you build a shorter underground station, but really that decision is not driven by the cost of the underground stations. It's driven by the space that we have to fit all the other stations, most of which are on the surface. So, you know, the whole project planning process has been a series of trade-offs. We thought it was worthwhile to make a new tunnel through downtown to create the level of quality that we don't have on Central Light Rail and respond to a major complaint we get about it, about how slow the service is on Howard Street. There is an expense associated with that. So, you know, we've balanced that against a variety of other decisions we've made with the project.
Two things that came out of conversations with different employees for the transit authority, drivers I'm talking about. Kind of in some ways, I think a much maligned group. There are drivers who do stop and get their laundry and stop and take. As I said, the reality is that most MTA drivers that I've ever encountered, others are do their work very hard and they work serious shifts and they have to confront a lot of people who are angry about a lot of little things like if you have a special voucher and come home with your kid, you have to spend more money and people don't know that, so they have to get these arguments about who you're serving and those things are real. But one of the things that some of the things that people are saying are that. The kind of the new buses that were bought, these kind of low riders that you all purchased for the system, they have the steps in the back. Almost every transit driver I talked to said our buses are always they're not full because people will not go up the steps. So people look at the bus, they think it's full, they don't want to get on the bus because it's too jammed in the front. These buses make no sense because of the step up in the back you have to make. That might sound minor, but when you hear like a people saying that who actually drive the buses and other people saying that who don't go up the steps for numerous reasons, afraid we're going to miss the stop, get stuck on the top, don't go up there. Were these buses a mix? Are we kind of – and these were buses that were rejected by a lot of other systems that ended up in Baltimore was also said. So your thoughts on that? Who tackles that one?
I'll start.
Okay.
Low-floor technology is something that's embraced throughout our industry, not only in the U.S. and North America, but in a lot of foreign countries as well. The low-floor technology does a couple of things. The old buses of the back in the day, you'd walk up three sets of stairs, and it had issues relative to people with
disabilities,
the elderly, and so on. So low-floor does two things for us. It allows you to load more quickly and pull away, which is a cost savings, and also increases speed. And you do end up, however, that in the rear part of the bus, there is that step up. So whether you're using an airport shuttle or using our vehicles, that technology has proven to be the better technology and not rejects from other places. So as people are replacing their fleet, they are going to low floor. The other thing is that in our process of meeting with our customers. We do customer satisfaction surveys. We talk to our employees. Those types of things are talked about and taken into consideration before we do long-term investments. And once we buy vehicles, there are certain manufacturers. Manufacturers are building vehicles that the industry is requiring and needing, and we don't necessarily buy a bus just for the Baltimore region.
Other questions, quick questions here before we run out of time. Is now one other thing that came up in an email that came in earlier this morning was that the transit riders, I'm trying to find the email, but I remember what it said, that the transit rider, the new red line, that the people hired for that red line will not be union workers. They'll be working for private companies. They'll be getting less money, less benefits.
I think that's jumping ahead a little bit. I mean, there are there's a variety of ways that you can staff transportation services. So our model so far at MTA has been you know, pretty uniform. Every MTA employee is a state employee. The folks on the operations side are represented by a union. They have a salary structure that's determined by that. What we're seeing across the country as transit agencies like ours bring new services online, they're confronted with a decision about how they're going to staff those services. And, you know, there's certainly benefits to going the private route to hire a contractor to do that, because the contractor can be much more flexible with regard to the very same issues that some of those riders are complaining about, the availability of staff, you know, whether people are present and ready to work. They have, you know, a flexibility in terms of how they manage their human resources that is not available to us as a public agency. But at the end of the day, you know, we've studied that phenomenon, and whether or not those employees are employees of the state, of the MTA, whether or not they're represented by a union, they tend to get pretty good wages, because the fact is any organization needs, you know, high quality, reliable, trained, you know, senior people, and so they have to pay to get that. So, you know, it's that is really the economic force that drives our industry and sets wages that are, you know, that are good family supporting wages. And I don't think that even if we staff the red line a different way, and we haven't made decisions about that at all, the consequence would be lower wage jobs.
One thing that I would like to add,
please,
the city of Baltimore is very excited about some of the partnerships that we're forming with the state and looking at the number of jobs that are going to be created by this tremendous investment and the state's commitment to working with local organizations to try to help prepare a workforce to be able to take on some of those jobs from right here in the Baltimore region. So we're very excited about all the work that the state is doing to make sure that wherever those jobs come from, a large number of them are expected to come from right here in Baltimore.
Well, I thank all of you for being here. I hope we can do this more. This has been an important conversation to have with our community. I want to thank you all for taking the time and being willing to do this. Robert L. Smith, who's the Maryland Transit Administrator, Henry Kay, Executive Director of Transit Development and Delivery for the Maryland Transit Administration, William Johnson, Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation, Frank Murphy, Deputy Director of the Baltimore City Department of Transportation. A lot of new faces and names on the block again. Good to have you all with us. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to look at the situation here on HBCU campuses with frats and gay and lesbian students. We're also then going to talk to Dr. Carla Kaplan, who joins with a book, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. Stay with us. We'll be right back.